So good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. We'll get started. So this week's Parashat Vayigash, is really the high point of the story of Yosef and his brothers. We read about the impassioned speech of Yehuda towards the ruler of Mitzrayim, who is disguised, and we know, as Yosef. Yosef is really moved and touched by Yehuda's words to the point that he cannot conceal his identity anymore. He reveals himself and his true identity to his brothers. And then there is the coming down of Yaakov and the rest of the family to Egypt. And then there's a reconciliation amongst the family. The family is together. They're in Egypt. God comes to Yaakov in a dream, tells him he's going to take care of him. And so really this week's parasha is about the final stages of the saga of Yosef and his brothers, the revealing, the reconciliation, and the coming down of the family to Mitzrayim. I went out on a limb this week, and so I hope it works out. We'll see how it goes. To focus on a part of the parasha that is almost always disregarded, almost always not spoken about. If you hear any rabbi speak this week, they're going to talk about Yehuda's speech, they're going to talk about Yosef revealing himself, they're going to talk about Yaakov coming down to Mitzrayim, and rightfully so. Those are really the highlighted events of this week's parasha. But there is a small cluster of pisukim at the very end of this week's parasha that talk about details that seem to be very insignificant, very often glossed over, because we don't really understand what they're doing there and why they're there and why they're important. And so we're gonna take on the challenge of reading these pisukim. There's a lot. There's about 15 pisukim. We'll read them in English, and certain parts we'll read in Hebrew. So I'm testing our reading capabilities and our textual capabilities. But given what I know about the ladies of this class, I think we're up to the task and up to the challenge. We're going to read them, and as we're reading them, try to think about what the message is. Why is this important? Why is the Torah telling this to us? We know the Torah does not waste any words. The Torah does not give us any superfluous details. So anything that the Torah is telling us here at the end of this week's parasha is something for us to learn from, something that's there for us to have a takeaway, maybe a foreshadowing of events to come. We don't know. And so really what this section is going to deal with is going to talk about Yosef's economic policies in the land of Mitzrayim. Again, we're still in the midst of a terrible famine that seems to be engulfing the entire Middle East, the countries Egypt, Israel, and many other bordering lands. The majority of the inhabited world is in a famine, as we're going to see. And so they still have to survive. And that's what Yosef tells his brothers. Hashem created all of this, right? In his emunah, he shows that all of this was orchestrated to get us down to Mitzrayim so we could survive during the years of famine. And Yosef takes on that responsibility of providing for his family. But in the course of that discussion, we find a lot about how Yosef dealt with the Egyptian population as well. How did he go about implementing the plan of giving out food to the people in Mitzrayim? And the Torah goes through a lot of detail on this matter, almost to the point where we say, what is the Torah doing here? Why is any of this important? So let's read together, noticing some points. If anything jumps out at you, feel free to ask questions or point something out. And then after we read it all, we'll sort of break it down into what may be one or two takeaways that we can get from this parasha. Yosef settled his father and his brothers, giving them holdings in the choicest part of the land in Egypt, in the regions of Ramesses, as Paro had commanded. So the Jewish people are down now, the family is down. Yosef gives them a portion of land in Goshen to rule for themselves and to inhabit themselves, the choicest of land, and this was agreed upon by Paro. Joseph sustained his father and his brothers and all his father's household with bread down to the little ones. Everybody had enough for what to be able to eat. And the contrast, now there was no bread in all the world, for the famine was very severe. Both the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Joseph gathered in all the money that was to be found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan as payment for the rations that were being procured, and Yosef brought the money into Paro's palace. So the first stage of Yosef's economic policy is people are going to pay for their food, and the ra'av is so, the famine is so heavy, and people are paying, that he ends up collecting all of the money and he now owns every dollar in Egypt, but people are still hungry. They still need more food. And when the money gave out in the land of Egypt, I'm in verse 15, and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us bread, lest we die before your very eyes, for the money is gone." What do we do now? We have no money. And Yosef said, "Bring me your livestock." So Yosef goes to plan B, and he takes the animals of Egypt. "And I will sell to you against your livestock if the money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Yosef brought them bread in exchange for the horses, for the stocks of sheep and cattle, and the donkeys. Thus he provided them with bread that year in exchange for all their livestock. So year one is he gathers all the money. Year two, they're now paying in animals. And by the end of year two, he's collected all of the animals in Egypt.
Seems like exploitation to me.
Okay, good. Doesn't seem that way. That's exactly what seems to be what is going on. Yeah.
Why aren't they eating their animals?
It seems like bread is the basic necessity. And I think they felt that either A, you could make the case that, again, Egyptian believed in gods, that their animals are gods. That's one possibility. Another possibility is they realized that animals won't sustain them. It's bread that really is, in this time, culturally, the food that's going to sustain them. It doesn't seem like culturally they ate animals. Animals were used maybe for other things. But that's also, it was a possibility, but I don't think they felt that would sustain them. So they bring all their livestock. I'm in verse 18. "And when that year was ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, 'We cannot hide from my lord that with all the money and animal stocks consigned to my lord, nothing is left at my lord's disposal save our persons and our farmland.'" They now have nothing. They have no money. They have no animals. All they have is themselves and their land. So they say, "Let us not perish before your eyes, both we and our land. Take us and our land in exchange for bread, and we with our land will be serfs to Par'o. Provide the seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become a waste." So what is the recommendation of the people? What do they say they want to do? They're willing to sell themselves and their land as slaves to Par'o, and then in exchange for their ability to live with bread. So Yosef gained possession of all the farmland of Egypt for Par'o, every Egyptian having sold his field because the famine was too much for them. Thus the land passed over to Par'o. So now Par'o not only has all the money and all the animals, he also now owns all the land. Basically everybody in Egypt has become a slave to Par'o. "And he removed the population town. And he removed the population town by town from one end of Egypt's border to the other." This is one of the more cryptic pesukim, and we really have to figure it out. I'll read it in Hebrew just to understand. Yosef does something, and it's not 100% clear to the commentaries what does he do. It says, "Ve'et ha'am he'evir oto le'arim." He moved the nation, the people, into cities. "Mikze gevul Mitzrayim ve'ad katzel." From one end of Egypt to the other end of Egypt. What is Yosef doing over here? What does he do with the people?
It's like congregating them into Egypt, like giving them borders, kind of like...
Okay.
Sounds like ghettos.
Yeah, it sounds like Holocaust.
Okay. It has little eerie shades over here going on with Par'o, and that hits to Danielle's point with the concept of maybe there's a little exploitation going on over here. We're going to see the rabbis try to kosher this on the part of Yosef. They try to explain it in a way that paints Yosef in a positive way. But it seems like Yosef is moving and displacing the people in Egypt into all different areas. Why he's doing that is an interesting question. Then the Torah changes gears and tells us an interesting law that Yosef enacts, or that was enacted by Par'o that Yosef abides by. "Only the land of the priests he did not take over. For the priests had an allotment from Par'o, and they lived off the allotment which Par'o had made to them. Therefore they did not sell their land." In other words, the Kohanim were already taken care of. Par'o had a law that there was a certain amount of food that would go automatically to the Kohanim, to the priests of Egypt, that they didn't have to pay for. So they didn't have to shell out their money, they didn't have to shell out any of their land that they owned, and therefore their land was not purchased by Par'o.
Wait, his name of priests or
Egyptian priests. Egyptian priests for their idols. No, in fact, that's exactly one of the points we're going to bring out a little bit, is the contrast between what's happening here with the Egyptian priests versus what happens with Jewish priests. We'll see something very different. Then Yosef said to the people, "Whereas I have this day acquired you and your land for Paro, here is seed for you to sow the land." So Yosef provides the people with seeds to be able to work the land. "And when harvest comes, you shall give 1/5 to Paro, and 4/5 shall be yours, as seed for the fields and as food for you, and those in your households, and as nourishment for your children." So Yosef sets the law that these people are going to work the land, and whatever they provide, 80% of it belongs to them, and 20% they have to give to Paro. That's the rule that he puts into place.
The original tax.
This is like basically like a tax. But it's surprising that this should be the law. Why is this surprising that this should be the law?
Because they're slaves.
They don't own anything, right? So we have to understand, what kind of law is this that Yosef is doing? Really, everything should go to Paro. I mean, we should continue, we should almost be living now in a... And I don't want to use the word communist society, because it's not really, it's worse than that. It's everything is owned by the king. And so everything should just go to the king, and the king should continue to divvy up. But that's not how Yosef does it. And they said, so look at the reaction of the people. They said, "You have saved our lives," they said to Yosef. "We are grateful to my Lord, and we shall be serfs to Paro." And Yosef made it into a land law in Egypt, which is still valid, that a fifth should be Paro's. Only the land of the priests did not become Paro's. The Torah reiterates again that the land of the Kohanim did not go to Paro. Thus Israel settled in the country of Egypt, in the region of Goshen. They acquired holdings in it and were fertile and increased greatly. That's a very interesting end pasuk. What is the Torah giving? That's the end of the parasha, by the way. The end of the parasha tells us the Jewish people were in the land of Goshen. Why does the Torah tell that to us? So I was contrasting the way Yosef dealt with the Jews, his own family, to the way he dealt with the Egyptians. The Jews settled in Egypt, in the regions of Goshen. They acquired holdings in it. In other words, the Jews what? The Jews owned their own land. All of the Egyptians, nobody owns their own land except for the priests. And the Jews, they own their own land. They own Goshen. They have control over it. And what happens? It's fertile. It produces for them. They grow. They get, you know, their businesses grow. And they increase greatly. Anybody's ever heard the stereotype of Jewish money, right? And the beracha that we have for Jewish money. This is where it starts. Right? This is where it starts. So before we start to pick apart some of the pieces here, let's just summarize what happens. Yosef provides for his family in the land of Goshen. The rest of Mitzrayim, however, is in dire need of food. Yosef collects the possessions of the Egyptians in stages. First he starts with the money, then he goes to the cattle and the livestock. Finally he takes the land, with the one caveat that he's not taking the land of the priests. Okay? What Yosef does though is he provides seeds for the people to be able to work the land. And Yosef then gives them the law that 20% has to go to Paro, the rest they could keep for themselves. One other thing that Yosef does that we didn't really explain or understand why he's doing it, is Yosef moves the people in and out of the cities. It seems like they're wandering, the people of Mitzrayim, in all different parts of the country. And as we mentioned, the Kohanim of Egypt are not moved. They get their land because they hold on to their lands and they're not sold. They are given a ration of bread directly from Paro. They don't have to buy anything. So the Kohanim are very much isolated and distinct from the rest of the people. At first glance, as you all pointed out, the policy does not seem like a very kind one. It seems like there's a lot of exploitation going on the part of Yosef and Paro. This seems like a ruse or a plot to end up acquiring all of the land of Egypt and everything that they own and enslaving the people, right? But the people respond to Yosef in a very positive way. They're very happy with the policies that are going on. They say, "You have saved our lives." How does this make sense? Yeah.
Well, when you slowly take everything away from a person, and then you give them back a small portion of their own thing, and now you're saying, "You own 4/5." They had nothing a day ago. So now that they were left with nothing, he's giving them 4/5, and he's buying their loyalty forever, because now they see him as this benevolent...
Interesting. So meaning that part of that, by doing it in stages, they're looking at the end and saying, "Wow, we at least we have something." But
if
you look,
they're buying their own food. They're buying their own food. They think they're just buying food, and then all of a sudden they have nothing.
Right.
And he turns around and he gives them back 4/5.
So does that perspective on it show Yosef and Paro as charitable or not? No, not necessarily.
Clever.
Maybe a little bit deceptive on a certain. It's again, it's exploitation. That perspective would look at it as they found a very interesting, they understood human psychology, and they found a way to be able to take everything from something and then give them back a little bit so that they're looked at as heroes. Right, they feel indebted to you. Okay, so that's an interesting perspective, and it's a very valid perspective as well. But that perspective kind of leaves Yosef in a bit of a negative light. So I'm going to try to maybe reverse it a little bit, although that's a very good pshat and a good explanation. I'm going to try to reverse it a little bit, and I want to ask three questions. Number one, what is Yosef doing here? What's his goal? How do we understand his policies and the people's reaction, the relationship to that? Number two, what are we learning from all of this? The Torah, like I said in the beginning, goes through a lot of detail to tell us what Yosef was doing here. How the money finished, and then the animals, and the four-fifths. What do we care about any of this? Why is any of this important? If I cut out these 15 pesukim, which many of us maybe haven't even read before, does it impact us in any way, shape, or form? Does it change the story? Are we now deficient in our understanding of what's taking on? Why? How?
The people of Goshen not be despised. I mean, how could the Jewish people not be looked at as people who are being spoiled?
Maybe that's why he moved them around, so they wouldn't be aware.
Yosef, you're saying, is moving them around so as not to draw attention on Goshen. Draw attention to Goshen.
That's a good point.
Okay, that's a potential. Howard just explained, how would moving them around create that problem? Because now
the people that are right next door, their neighbors, see that they own it, but now they're moved. They don't see anymore what's going on. The new people come and they don't know. Mm-hmm. If you're being moved around, you really don't know.
So each person who's being moved around thinks that the Jews had just arrived there.
They don't know. They're always being displaced.
It's possible. Although I feel like the likelihood would eventually come out that, hey, how come the Jews have been here in the same spot? Eventually someone would probably catch on to that ruse a little bit.
They even want to live with them, eat with them, or whatever.
So that's a good point. The relationship between the Egyptians and the Jews and the Ivrim has to also be looked at over here. And we're going to talk a lot about that because Yosef also has that problem. Yosef is an Egyptian leader who is clearly favoring his own family and needs to now smooth things over. He's got a lot of political issues to bend over here. He wants to take care of his own family. He doesn't want to look like he's favorites. He's playing favorites. And at the same time, the people of Egypt don't exactly love the Jewish people to begin with. So that's something that we're going to really delve into and take a look at. But that's as good an explanation as any as to why he's potentially moving them around. Yeah.
Really not talking about a nation yet because it's only 3 years after they got there and they came there with 70 people.
Right, we're probably talking about a population of maybe
babies. So it's
maybe
ostentatious group.
Correct. They maybe didn't stick out, but they have their own land. Right, but they have their own land. They own their own land, and they're being provided without having to pay and do all the other things that the Egyptians have. We don't know. Right. That's true. But I think when you add on the already tense relationship that the Jews have with the Egyptians, I think they might stick out. Ah, good. So just to add that in, we already have something that was mentioned before, that when the brothers, before they knew about Yosef, who he was, when the brothers came down and Yosef made a meal with his brothers, the Torah tells us that they separated Yosef and his brothers from the rest of the Egyptians when they ate. Because the Torah tells us it was an abomination. The Torah is a very strong word. It was a to'eva, an abomination for Egyptian people to eat bread, to break bread with people from the land of Canaan, with Jews who came, with Ivrim, with those who came from the family of where the Jews descend from. So already there's a clear tension between these two families. So when you add that in, what Yosef is doing is pretty dicey. He's taking a really big risk. He has a lot of guts for what he's going to do. The last question that I have are the actions of Yosef viewed favorably or not being viewed favorably? We know that the Mitzrim view it favorably, but we, from an objective perspective, are we meant to learn that Yosef acted righteously or maybe not? Maybe Yosef did not act in a righteous manner. Already some of our explanations may be tilting towards Yosef having taken advantage of his people and playing favorites, which at a time of famine might not be looked at objectively as a pretty moral act.
Also kind of exiling the people of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, he's the first one to be exiled.
Okay. So he's not showing exactly the right amount of empathy for his people.
No, but not only that. I'm saying, I think that later on, when he ends up separating from Yehuda and being exiled first, and then we never see him again. I think that's kind of like what he was doing to the people of Egypt. He was mm-hmm. exiling them. He was taking them out of their homes. He was moving them all over the place.
Right.
He was exploiting them.
Okay. Right. So that's a good view. I want to read to you for a minute just how the rabbis view what Yosef did by moving the people out. Rashi brings an explanation here when he moved the people around. Rashi says, Lehodiacha shivho shel Yosef, to show you the praise of Yosef, his greatness. Why did he do this? Shenitkaven hasir hirpa me'al ehav. He tried to remove the shame and embarrassment from his own family. Shelo yehu korim otam golim, that they should not call them people who are in exile. In other words, Yosef exiled his own people to create the concept that everybody here is a refugee. Everybody is exiled. You're all displaced. So otherwise, the Jews clearly stick out as a sore thumb, as people having been exiled from their land and living in a foreign country, not knowing what's going on. Everyone else is nice and comfortable in their particular areas. So Yosef didn't want to embarrass his family or have the shame of that stigma on his family. So he moved everybody around to make everybody as if they're all refugees. That's how the rabbis look at it.
That's the whole da'ah of Yosef?
That's the shevach, the praise of Yosef, looking out, caring about the shame of his family. Now the rabbis always have a bit of a, I don't want to use the word bias because that's like a little bit of a negative word, but they're always going to look at things from the perspective of the Jewish people, from Am Yisrael. Wow, look at the greatness of Yosef. He protected the dignity of his family, of the Jewish people. That's something to be praised. On the flip side, you could say, but Yosef also has a responsibility towards his people. There's also general morality to humanity. So was this necessarily something that he should have done or not? Yeah.
How much of this is his role as second to the king, mm. following the king's orders, versus we're placing the role like this was his idea?
A lot. A lot. So you know what? Now that you're bringing that up, I'll start with that. I was going to start with something else, but I'll start with that to tackle that point. Which is, I think if we look at Yosef's role and what he has to do, his challenge as being the second in command, the Egyptian viceroy taking care of his people, we'll actually see, if we look at it from his perspective, that he does a tremendous kindness for his people within what he has the ability to do. So to understand this, we really have to get into Yosef's position. Put yourself in Yosef's shoes now. Yosef is a Hebrew person. He's from the land of Ivri, which we know is not looked upon very highly. He was once imprisoned, taken out of prison, and immediately shot up to be the second in command over Egypt. Okay? So Yosef has to do a magic act. He has to balance the loyalty to Paro. He owes a tremendous amount to Paro. It was Paro who took him out. It's Paro who gave him the second in command. It's Paro who gave him a wife to be able to have children. It's Paro who has told that nobody shall raise their hand without Yosef's word. Paro is his new father figure. He owes a tremendous amount to Paro. So he has to display loyalty to Paro. At the same time, he wants to also take care of his own particular family. Now, we can't forget Yosef's origins. Yosef is a Hebrew person, which we said are not particularly loved by the Egyptians. Okay? And to do so, what does he do strategically? And Paro helps him to do this. He takes on an Egyptian personality. Yosef becomes Egyptian. What does he do? What are some things that he does to make himself Egyptian? Huh? He takes on the dress. What else? Yeah. What does he do? He takes the king's name. Paro gives him an Egyptian name, Tzafnat Paaneach. That's what the people call him. And he embraces this Egyptian name. The Torah calls him Yosef all the time because that's how we know him. But it's very likely that the people, in fact the Torah tells it to us, the people referred to him by his Egyptian name. He takes on an Egyptian name. He has Egyptian dress. He's given an Egyptian wife. Okay? Look at the names of his children. Yes. It's definitely assimilation to a certain degree.
Why is that okay for him?
So we're going to see. Yosef had to assimilate to a certain degree. Look how he tries to balance it. Huh?
This seems like above and beyond.
Well, if he's going to maintain his position as second in command, which I think he believes God has put him into that position for a very specific purpose, which he realizes later when his family comes down. He realizes that was his job to be there. He needs to uphold that position that God has given to him. So he understands that he has to make certain concessions. So he plays, he walks a tightrope. Mosef has to walk a very fine line between accepting certain parts of assimilation while, or portraying at least outwardly that he has assimilated, while still maintaining his Jewish roots. He has to do a very interesting walk over here. Look at the names of his two children. His first son is Menashe. What does Menashe mean? Ki nashani Elohim et kol amali. God has made me forget about my parents' house. That's his name. He names his kid, I have forgotten about my parents' house. That's his first kid's name. What? Correct. That's his name. That's the name he gives. But then look at the second name for his child. Ephraim, he tells him, Ki Ephrani Elohim, God has made me great, Be'eretz Oni, in the land of my suffering. What's the land of his suffering? Egypt. He calls Egypt the land of his suffering. So look at the push and pull that Yosef is dealing with over here. On the one hand, he has quote unquote forgotten. He at least is portraying outwardly that he is all Egyptian. He has forgotten about the home, his home, his roots, and his heritage. At the same time, he still identifies Egypt as the place of his suffering. So he is, again, walking a tight line between the two, trying to hold on to what he had in the past, while still portraying outwardly that he is Egyptian in order to hold that post. Jenny?
But like, just to answer what Kim said, isn't that the beauty of Yosef, that he was able to maintain his Judaism? And that's why, like, when we bless our sons Friday night, we bless them to be like Ephraim and Menashe.
Interesting. Ephraim and Menashe,
like,
right.
They should continue their Judaism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And so, yeah, Yosef becomes the paradigmatic character of somebody who can live in a foreign land and still maintain what makes him identify as a Jew. And he becomes that for a reason. He married an Egyptian woman. There's no question. He married an Egyptian woman. He's allowed. That's it. He did it. Now, now we can get into did she converted and what again, what's going on behind the scenes in their own home? Are they, what Jewish values they're portraying? Again, we would assume he's called Yosef HaTzadik. He got to the to the level that he got with a certain amount of holding on to his Jewish roots. And we know that we see, and just seeing his later actions, we see that he held on to his Jewish identity a tremendous amount. When his family comes in, we're going to see he takes care of them. And look what he does to his family, by the way. What does he do to his family? When his family comes, what does he do? But in terms of, what?
You mean when he separated?
He keeps them separate, right? So look what he does. He's aware. He understands the ramifications of assimilation and what he's doing. Potentially, he could have looked at his own situation and said, I don't want this for my family. And so he does everything in his power to keep his family completely separate. You can make the argument, if you pay attention, we don't have time to really look at the psukim, but you can make the argument that when his family comes down, Paro is inviting Yaakov and his family to come down to do what? He wants them to be a part of the Egyptian court. He wants to assimilate them as well. He says, if this is, I got one Yosef, imagine when I get 10 more brothers, 11 more brothers, plus his father, what I could do to Egypt with that. He wants to assimilate them. Yosef creates this whole ruse, tell them you're shepherds so that they'll put you here and then you'll be about. He tries to keep them separate. He doesn't want for his family what he had to experience and go through. So he has to deal with his particular challenge, but he's not throwing that challenge in front of the rest of his family. And so again, Yosef is walking that tight line. Yeah, Danielle, you have a question? Okay. So Paro goes to great lengths to help Yosef hide his Jewish identity by giving him all of these things because he doesn't want the disapproval of everybody else. Whether or not the rest of Egypt approved of Paro's very liberal decision to put a Jewish person, a Hebrew, as the second in command, probably would have gotten a lot of pushback. But he kind of conceals it, he hides it, and he keeps it under wraps. So, and Yosef tries to do this as well. What does Yosef do when he reveals himself to his brothers? He says, I want everybody out of the room. He kicks out all of the Egyptians. So most of the commentaries explain he didn't want to embarrass his brothers when he revealed that they had sold him into slavery. But another potential explanation is he does not want to reveal to everybody that these are his brothers, that he's in fact a Hebrew person. Many people might not be aware of that fact. Now that spreads and it eventually gets out and everybody finds out. At that point, Yosef had enough standing already to where he was that everybody still accepted him. He had enough clout to be able to hold his position. But from his perspective, he thought, I don't want everybody to know that I'm a Hebrew. It's not going to look so great. It's going to challenge my ability to do what I'm doing here down in Egypt to help protect my family. And so that's really where Yosef now is lying. He's balancing his loyalty to Paro and his position as an Egyptian leader together with his relationship with his family and his identity as a Hebrew. Now, the rabbis say something phenomenal. With all this in mind, the rabbis say Paro had a very big plan with the food. What did Paro want to do? Paro wanted to enslave his own people. Paro, the rabbis say, hid the food from his people. He was willing to let people of his own nation die to the point where they would grovel and beg that we'll do anything to have the food, we'll become slaves. He wanted to enslave and entrap his own people. Yosef knows this plot. And so what does Yosef try to do? He knows he can't get around it completely. But he tries to at least lessen the blow. He tries to create a system in which it looks like he's exploiting the people, but he's doing it in a much kinder version than what Paro wants to do. I'll give you an example. The Pasuk tells us that there's bread in Egypt. There's bread in Egypt. But it says the people come screaming to Paro, we're starving, where's the bread? The rabbis say he hid the bread. He wasn't willing to give it to them. He wanted this from them. He tells them, go to Yosef. Yosef has to think to himself, what am I going to do? How do I help these people without undermining my relationship with Paro? So he comes up with a plan. He says, okay, you're going to buy the money. Paro can't disagree with that. Okay, he buys the money. He gets all the money. Buy the money with your livestock. Give me the land, right? Now, it's interesting. The people say, we'll give you ourselves and the land. What does Yosef take? He only takes the land. He doesn't take them. He never enslaves the people. He moves them around from place to place to give the imagery, the portrayal towards Paro, that everybody is moving around, everybody belongs to us, nobody's owning the land. But it's allowing that moving around of everybody is avoiding taking everybody as slaves. Yosef creates this whole economic policy so as not to enslave the people. He doesn't want to make them slaves. He doesn't want to exploit them to the extent that Paro wants to. And the people recognize this. That's why the people come to him at the end and say, Hechayitanu, you've given us life. You've given us the ability not just to survive, but to continue to be free. And his final decree is, you'll work the land and you'll give 20% to Paro. So you're attached to Paro. This maybe appeased Paro. Paro was happy that he was getting something, but it still allowed the people to keep their freedom. That's really what Yosef is trying to do the entire time. And if we look at it from this perspective, it's a tremendous kindness, a tremendously elevated act that Yosef does, more so than just what he does towards his family, but towards his own people, the Egyptian people. He treats them in a way that is with tremendous compassion and mercy, given the framework that Yosef is working within. Yeah?
I don't know. It seems antithetical to the progression of the Pesukim.
How?
The whole point is Yosef. Mm-hmm. Then it brings in Paro when the one law that he wanted was that the Kohanim should have
the
land.
So you're saying, bring in
Yosef. If you're going to say that Yosef is working for Paro this whole time and having Paro's ideas in mind, why bring in Paro's name in the middle of the business?
With the Kohanim thing? So that's a good question. What Paro is doing with the Kohanim, I think, becomes a bit of a separate idea. And I want to talk about that in a minute. But I think that what Paro is doing and why they're telling us that it was a chok from Paro is because Paro wants to hold on to the concept of the Kohanim and the priests. He doesn't want to upset the religious idol worship aspect of it. That's Paro's motivation and agenda. But he doesn't care about the rest of the people. He says, I want you to hold on to the Kohanim because we need to appease them and give them. He still believed in the religious aspect of it, that his success was coming from that perspective. But in terms of exploiting the actual people, he said he's okay with that. But he allows Yosef to do it.
But where in the Pesukim do we even hint out that Yosef was being commanded by Paro, even
look what he says. It says Vayiken Yosef et kol admat Mitzrayim leFaro. He purchases it for Paro. Everything is to Paro. He's working for Paro, right? He's clearly doing all of these things in hopes that Paro will be happy with the process of how they're acquiring all of the assets of the land of Mitzrayim.
It's still all his ideas.
It's all of his ideas. For sure, they're Yosef's ideas. But what I'm saying, what I'm suggesting is working beneath it is that Yosef has to come up with these ideas to balance out what he wants to do towards the people versus what Paro really wants them. And you need a little bit of the rabbi's perspective on Paro and his desire to enslave the people to kind of help you out with that. Now, what's ironic about all of this, the great irony of it is Yosef does everything to not enslave the Egyptian people, and in two parashiyot from now, the Egyptian people will enslave him, mm-hmm. will enslave his own family. And why do they enslave his own family? Potentially because of Yosef's favoritism towards his family. In the end of the day, the people catch on to the fact that he has separated them in Goshen, which is
backfired.
In essence, it backfired. That doesn't mean that Yosef did the wrong thing. It just means that Hashem is going to make it happen however he wants to make it happen, right? But Yosef, from his perspective, was doing the right thing in taking care of his family by giving... He had to. For sure he had to. What's ironic, though, about the whole story is it's very likely that at a certain point, two parashiyot down the road, when the new Paro comes, and he doesn't know Yosef, and he starts looking around going, my Egyptian people don't own land, and these Jewish people own land... My Egyptian people are moving around in cities and don't have anything to call their own, and these Jews do? There's something wrong about that. That's not going to fit and jive with me. In Yosef's time, it worked because the people were accepting of what Yosef did. Once Yosef was gone, they lost all of that opportunity. And now they're looking at the disparity between Egyptian people versus Jewish people, and they're saying, that's not going to happen for us. So it's Yosef's own economic policies and the way he treats it that could potentially lead that do lead to the enslavement of the Jewish people, right? That doesn't mean Yosef was wrong. It just means that look at the way Hashem crafts the story, right? Yosef's own praiseworthy actions are what God uses to actually enslave the Jewish people eventually down the road. It's an amazing thing when you look at the way we were talking before the class about how God allows things to happen, right? I mean, this is, you don't get it bigger than this, right? The thing that Yosef was doing to protect his family, help his family, the thing that he should have done, God ends up making that backfire on them to become slaves. Why? Because in the end of the day, that's what was necessary. That's what God wanted. That was supposed to happen. Why? I mean, the rabbis praise him for it because his whole purpose of being there was to take care of his family. He says multiple times, and the Torah points it out. Oh, Yosef is, he tells it, Kilim mihya shelahani alechem. God has sent me to be able to give you food, to be able to take care of you, to sustain you, to allow you to live. Exactly. Everything was there for him to be there. So Yosef saw this as the fulfillment of his destiny to be able to take care of his family. That's how he fulfills his dreams. Go back to his dreams. What are his dreams? There are sheaves of wheat standing around, bowing down to him. Sheaves of wheat. He's representing the fact that he's going to take care of his family with wheat. He's going to provide them with bread. This is the fulfillment of his destiny, the fulfillment of his dreams, the fulfillment of everything that has led him to this point is to take care of his family, and it's that very thing that's going to lead his own family into slavery. Yes.
So I feel like if they were they assimilating at that time a little bit, like, or getting comfortable in the land that Hashem needed to
potentially
wake them up and say, "You're getting too comfortable here. I'm moving you out."
So potentially, I mean, look, it says Vayeshiv Yisrael be'eretz Mitzrayim be'eretz Goshen. They are fruitful. They hold on to the land. They're multiplying in the land. They're very successful, and so they could have been looking at Egyptian life as very beneficial for them, and that could have been the wake up call that God sent to them as. You know, and one thing you could take away always, I agree with you, is that as much as when Jews want to assimilate, non-Jews will never let us assimilate.
Right.
They'll never let us, right?
Oh, the
they'll never let us, right? Sometimes they want us to, but eventually you'll always still be a Jew in the end of the day. And so we try sometimes to assimilate. We think, oh, we'll assimilate and they'll like us, right? Nazi Germany, they assimilate. Oh, they're taking a bit. You'll always be, in the end of the day, a Jew. God will often do things to separate you. And so Yosef keeps them separate for the hope of not assimilating, whether they did or didn't. The rabbis seem to say the opposite. They seem to say that they didn't.
Yeah, but the whole point is to be like Yosef. To balance the assimilation.
Yeah.
To balance the part where you take the good from the actual galut that you're in and to relate to the good that, to relate to the galut that you're in.
Yes. I mean, sometimes it's necessary.
Your relationship.
I don't know if that's what they want us to do versus if that's maybe what is sometimes necessary. I think that that's really what it is. From my perspective is, he was successful because it was successful because it was necessary for him. That's what I'm saying. I think Yosef's, and we could debate this. It's definitely a hot topic to look at, especially for people who live outside of the land of Israel, and we don't we're amongst other nations. I think that Yosef's perspective was I have to assimilate. He didn't have a choice. And so Yosef becomes the person who says, when you have to assimilate, when it's necessary, when you're living amongst other lands, how do you deal with it? How do you balance it? At the same token, Yosef himself might look at his family and say, I don't want you to have to necessarily do it. And so he's trying to keep them separate. That ends up leading them into a problem. So you could say maybe he was wrong for doing it that way. I don't know. I don't look at it that way. I think that that was really more how Hashem wanted to orchestrate the things than it would have come in any which way. There are a lot of different sources you could bring within this whole story to bring out the concept of assimilation or not assimilation. It's an interesting debate that you could have within the story for sure. So just to wrap it up, I guess just to end it, we talked about Yosef's economic policies. We talked about what he was trying to accomplish. We talked about, at least from my perspective, the great kindness that Yosef was trying to do by not exploiting the people the way Paro wanted, and trying to meld the two to be something that he could morally accept, together with the fact that the events that Yosef does end up leading to the eventual exile. And so when we ask the question, why are these pisukim here? Why are these details here? It could be that this is the foreshadowing. These pisukim are here to foreshadow what will eventually occur in the enslavement in Parashat Shemot. And also the irony of the fact that Yosef, while not enslaving the Egyptian people, ends up getting repaid back within the enslavement of his own people. And that's typical of Jewish history, right? We behave nicely and with a proper respect towards others, and we get repaid back with the exact opposite from the other nations of the world. And so that's something, that's a theme that has repeated itself throughout history. There was one other point that I wanted to discuss about the Kohanim. Just briefly, I'll say, you notice that the Kohanim of Egypt are very different than the Kohanim that we have in Judaism. Kohanim in Judaism don't own land. They're not allowed to own land. In Egypt, it's the exact opposite. Paro protected their land and said they're not allowed to sell their land. We can't take the land from them. What's the difference on that? So I saw an interesting explanation that the Kohanim in amongst the Jewish people are also the teachers. They're also the ones who educate the people. And so they don't own land because their job is to be moving around. The Kohanim don't have a specific place where they are rooted. They go around Am Yisrael teaching Torah to all the different areas. They're the educational system of the Jewish people. In Egypt, it was the exact opposite. The Kohanim stay put, and the people were moving around, right? And so they never get an opportunity to grow in any kind of way, right? They just look at these people as being isolated and elitist kinds of people in Egyptian society, while they're poor and downtrodden. In Judaism, it's the opposite. The Kohen is not an elitist. He is someone who's in charge of elevating the rest of the people by going around and teaching Torah. So this, another theme present in these details of these Pesukim is the contrast between the way the Kohanim are viewed in Egypt versus the way the Kohanim are viewed in Mitzrayim. The big takeaway for me is the kindness of Yosef, the way he doesn't exploit his people, and the morality with which he tries to behave. I think that's something that we can use and take with us each and every day, trying to not exploit others, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish, trying to see the humanity in every single person and expressing kindness towards them. Any last questions or comments or thoughts? Okay.
Thank you.
Have a great day.